Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. To lead off today's program, we're going to talk about the death of the American sedan. After more than a century-long run, automakers like Ford can no longer escape the obvious, according to the Washington Post. Demand for traditional cars is drying up. As part of a massive cost-cutting initiative, Ford announced this summer that it plans to walk away from its U.S. passenger sedan business after years of declining sales. It's eliminating the Fiesta, the Fusion, Taurus, and C-Max models. Aside from Mustang sports cars, a new Focus crossover, and a battery electric line which is due in 2022, the Detroit automaker's lineup will be composed entirely of SUVs and trucks. By abandoning sedans, Ford will prune $11.5 billion in costs on top of another $14 billion in previously announced cuts. This is a momentous shift. Just a decade ago, with gas prices surging, the compact Focus and midsize Fusion spearheaded a push to provide stylish and fuel-efficient cars. But Americans are abandoning sedans and choosing trucks and SUVs, showing a preference for rides that are higher off the ground and roomy enough to accommodate families. Last year, Ford Fusion sales skidded 21%. More about this at another time, but you can look at The Week magazine of May 11th. Now it's time for ID, what Americans should expect. Preparations are underway for broad enforcement of ID cards beginning in 2020. Changes are coming to identification requirements for residents of the United States. In response to a 2005 federal law, states are ramping up security measures involved in issuing driver's licenses and other identification cards. The question is, what are real IDs? A real ID can be either an identification card or a driver's license that meets stepped-up federal standards. It will be needed to access federal facilities, to enter nuclear power plants, and board federally regulated commercial aircraft. Just why was this legislation passed? Congress passed the Real ID Act in 2005 in response to 9/11. Some of the hijackers aboard the four flights that crashed that day used fraudulent IDs. The Real ID Act strives to make securing fake IDs more difficult. When will the Real ID be enforced? Well, that depends on state. For those who have been granted an extension, October 1st, 2020, is the hard deadline. After that date, a real ID will be required to fly, to access restricted and semi-restricted federal facilities, and enter nuclear plants. Just what do people need to apply for a real ID card? Applications for a real ID can be made at a local Department of Motor Vehicles. The required documentation depends on personal circumstances, but it is likely to include a Social Security card or tax form, a birth certificate, passport, or immigration form, and two proofs of state residency, such as a current utility bill. Will real ID be required anytime people need proof of identity? Not necessarily. The Real ID Act does not apply to voting or registering to vote, attending court proceedings, assessing health services at hospitals, for example, entering public areas, or even driving per se. Also, the law does not prohibit an agency from accepting other forms of identifications, such as a U.S. passport. The new look of the Real ID cards will be similar to the current driver's licenses, except they'll have a gold star in the upper right-hand corner. If you'd like more information about this, including a map which shows the states that are in compliance, have received an extension, or have not been compliant, look at the Christian Science Monitor Weekly, April 16th, 2018. Today, we have bright spots in conservation for you. The past 48 years since the first Earth Day on April 22, 1970, have been marked by significant environmental challenges that continue to imperil large swaths of the planet. The coal-spewing industrial age is being followed by a period of population growth, exploitation of natural resources, and unchecked waste. Progress on these fronts has been slow, despite heightened public awareness of the impact of human activity on the plant's core ecological processes. The modern environmental movement has not been in vain, however. Technical advances, environmental regulations, and public conservation efforts have demonstrated quantifiable successes, such as improvements in air and water purity and energy efficiency in Western countries. Here are some of the bright spots in the struggle to protect the environment. First of all, the drop in U.S. emissions of six common air pollutants, including carbon monoxide, lead, and fine particles, between 1970, when the Clean Air Act was passed, and 2016, was 73%. Although the population and energy usage of the United States has increased, innovations in fuel efficiency and the regulation of major polluters have had a marked success. Globally, however, air pollution continues to increase, especially in low- and middle-income countries. Around the world, carbon dioxide emissions are once again on the rise after holding flat for 3 years. And now on to water. Gallons of water per day that the U.S. used in 2010, after peaking at 440 billion gallons per day in 1980, was 350 billion gallons. Per person, that comes to a decrease of 800 gallons a day. This was made possible largely due to increased water efficiency in agriculture and thermoelectric power. U.S. household water use has also been tracking downward since the adoption of national water efficiency standards in 1992. While conservation is an important part of water scarcity solutions, over 1 billion people worldwide still lack access to clean water. And to the forests. Square miles of forest replanted every year. Still, deforestation occurs at a rate of more than 42,000 miles, square miles a year. Trees help clean our water, our air, and soil, and could help reduce worldwide CO2 levels. The number that I was leading into was 20,000 square miles of forest have been replanted every year. More nations are recognizing the economic and ecological value of forests and investing in reforestation projects. In January, China announced plans to plant enough trees in 2018 to cover an area the size of Ireland, that is 27,000 square miles. Around the same time, Great Britain announced plans to plant 50 million trees across a 97-mile ribbon of woodland. An interesting lead-in to this next topic. It's God Save Texas. That's the name of a new book, God Save Texas, A Journey into the Soul of the Lone Star State, by Lawrence Wright and published by NOMF. It can be hard to explain the appeal of our state to outsiders, said a Texas native. An NPR organization. Journalist and Pulitzer Prize winner Lawrence Wright knows that all too well. He was raised in Abilene. He moved to Dallas just a few years before John Kennedy was assassinated, and he has spent the last 38 years living in Austin, Texas, often embarrassed and repelled by the way politics is practiced in the state's capital. But Wright, who is a staff writer at The New Yorker, is also one of the most talented journalists Texas has ever produced. And with his book, God Save Texas, he's created a thoughtful portrait that balances the good and the bad. It's essential reading for anyone who believes, as Wright does, that Texas' outsized influence on today's national political culture will only grow in the decades to come. Texas is, of course, far too big to be just one thing, according to Chris Vognar in the Dallas Morning News. Wright asks us to think of it as two places, AM Texas and FM Texas, one rural or suburban and Republican, and the other urban, multi-ethnic, and Democratic. He also reminds us that Texas may be far different in 2050, when its population will nearly match that of California and New York combined. There's no need to look further for why Wright has stayed in Texas so long, despite believing that it's nurtured an immature political culture that has already done terrible damage to the nation, according to Andrew Graybill in Texas Monthly. In short, it matters and deeply. In Wright's words, Texas is home to a culture that's not fully formed, but also growing in influence. It's dangerous, and it's magnificent in its potential. Next on our list today, the question, what are you reading? Christian Science Monitor Weekly readers have been reading the following books, and they have written the editor to let the person know what books they like and why they like them. First of all, Joseph Roby III from Beaverton, Oregon, says that The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today by Thomas Ricks explores great American generals and, in some cases, as with Douglas MacArthur, debunks legends. And then Lee Pomeroy from Mankato, Minnesota says, I am reading Growing a Revolution by David Montgomery. This argues that the farming system of plowing and monocropping so prevalent today is totally wrong. He offers solutions based on years of research that provide a better alternative. And third on our list today, Camille Dull from Lakewood, California. She's written in about Laughing Boy by Oliver Lafarge. This is a wonderfully written novel, a romantic classic set at a high point of the strength, depth, and sensitivity of Navajo culture. And then Betty Hall from Quincy, California, writes, I've just read the nonfiction book Democracy in Chains by Nancy MacLean. It documents how the radical right has been progressively destroying democracy in the United States and stealthily replacing it with an oligarchic system in which the economic and political power is concentrated in the hands of a few. This book is eye-opening. It is chilling and it is timely reading for all who want to protect American self-government and democracy itself. These are the people who wrote in to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly about the April 9th issue this summer. All right, listeners, it's now time for questions and answers. As you may remember from past programs, people write into the Smithsonian Magazine with questions for the experts at that institution. And this from the April issue, 2018. The first question, how come I see fireflies in New York, Illinois, Iowa, and all through the South, but not in the West? The answer to that is, you can see fireflies in the West, but you have to look a lot harder. There's a kind of firefly continental divide, and it has to do with flashing behavior among adults. Among eastern species, males flash while they're in flight to attract females. Those species don't live farther west than Kansas, except for a few isolated populations. Out west, on the other hand, it's the adult females that glow, but only while they're on the ground and very faintly, so faintly that their glow is hardly detectable, even to a human eye fully adapted to the dark. And few people venture out without a flashlight or other light on. Another question that has been submitted to the Smithsonian experts. Of the 120,000 Japanese Americans who were interned for security reasons during World War II, how many were convicted of spying against the United States? The answer to this is none. Despite aggressive investigating, the U.S. government did convict 10 people of spying for Japan, but they were all Caucasian. In 1988, President Ronald Reagan signed the Civil Liberties Act, which formally apologized for the internment and compensated each surviving internee with $20,000. Still, the Supreme Court has upheld the government's right to hold citizens without trial or hearing in wartime. A third question of the day. Is the speed of light finite? Is it limited to 186,000 miles per second? Well, yes, on both counts. In 1905, Albert Einstein realized that the speed of light is a constant of nature. This serves as the basis of his special theory of relativity, which has been tested and it has been confirmed by many scientists. It states that no material object can move faster than that speed, and that the speed does not change depending upon your frame of reference. If you're near the speed of light, time does slow down. So if you boarded a super-fast spacecraft, you would age more slowly than your relatives on Earth. And lastly for today, the question is, will the state of Michigan elect a Muslim this year? In April 2007, a college senior named Abdul Rahman El Said delivered a 6-minute commencement speech at his graduation ceremony at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. A few minutes later, Bill Clinton, the keynote speaker, took the microphone, and after the ceremony, Dr. El Said says in an interview the former president told him, "I hope someday you'll consider running for office." Well, he is running for governor this year in Michigan on the Democratic ticket. The primary is today. And in the next program, I may be able to tell you whether or not the state of Michigan selects a Muslim from the primary to run against the Republican incumbent.